Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Hello, I'm Susan Violante. I'm your host for today. I'm really excited to be speaking on the phone with Alan Austin, author of The Cottage. In this standalone sequel of his first book, The Adagio, Duncan, the protagonist, travels to Europe to oversee a film quest for the real Shakespeare as he becomes a suspect in the disappearance of Terry, his fiancée. Soon, he finds himself tangled in an adventure as Terry's disappearance at home becomes inexplicably intertwined with the mysteries in England. But before we start, let's learn a little bit more about Alan. Alan Austin was an investigative reporter and documentary filmmaker for almost 40 years, working for CBS stations in Topeka, Kansas, and Minneapolis, Minnesota, and for PBS, Frontline, and Nova. His documentaries won 2 National Emmys, 3 Peabodys, 2 DuPont Columbia University Awards, and 3 Sigma Delta Chi Journalism Awards. One of his investigations resulted in the exoneration of and freedom of a man who had been falsely convicted of 2 rapes in Houston, Texas. Another, the Shakespeare mystery, inspired the book The Cottage. For more information, you can visit him at his website at alankaustin.authorsexpress.com, and that is authors with no e on express.com. Hi, Alan. How are you today?
I'm fine. How are you?
Pretty good. Thank you so much for coming to Inside Scoop Live. I am actually a big, big fan of documentaries. I'm pretty sure I must have seen yours, too. It's just something that I'm addicted to. I watch all kinds of documentaries, and it's the only thing that I really watch on TV.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, so I'm really excited to talk about your book as well, The Cottage. Before, though, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I started as a disc jockey and got fired for playing Frank Sinatra. It's a no-no. Casting around for a job, there was an opening for a reporter in Topeka, Kansas. I didn't even know how to type. But it worked out. I guess I stumbled into a few good stories and finally wound up in Minneapolis and began to do documentaries, and that turned out to be just right for me.
Mm-hmm.
I like finding things out. I like finding things out that people don't want me to know.
That's the best documentary there.
And then I like telling it, and that's more or less the theme of the book. That's how it starts anyway, The Cottage.
Mm-hmm. How do you come up with your ideas for a documentary? I mean, are they usually – I used to be a potter, and my best pieces were by accident.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering how these documentaries come about. This is a question that I've had in my mind for a long time, by the way. How did they come about?
The one about Shakespeare, you mean?
Yeah, especially that one. Because
yeah.
It's such that, you know, and for our listeners, you know, the question is, who was really Shakespeare?
Yeah.
And you did a documentary about that, and we'll talk more about how The Cottage came about, too. But I just wonder, how can an idea like that come out of somebody's mind? You know, well, let me find out who this guy was and, you know, and prove everybody wrong.
I first ran across this question, this mystery,
mm-hmm.
about 30 years ago when I read Mark Twain's autobiography. And he spends a lot of time talking about Shakespeare, and he really just cut him to ribbons. It exposed him as being, as barely having existed. There's just no evidence of his having written anything. Everything that you read about the man from Stratford is just supposition. He must have done this. He may have done this. We can only suppose that he did this and that. The only real fact about him, and even it is iffy, is that he apparently as a child poached a deer. That really isn't enough to qualify him as Shakespeare. So I about died laughing reading it. And then I read a book by Charlton Ogburn,
mm-hmm.
who spent his life trying to find out who Shakespeare was, and he found that he wasn't the first to discover this, but he was the one who really nailed it down, that it was Edward de Vere, the 17th Earl of Oxford, who was a really quite a guy. He was a swashbuckling guy who was intimate with the Queen, Queen Elizabeth I,
mm-hmm.
And he convinced me pretty much. And then I just sort of fell into this documentary, the Frontline, which is a PBS arm, decided they wanted to tackle this question and hired me to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I became amazed at how little there is showing that the guy from Stratford was Shakespeare. It just, there's just nothing to go on. There is no evidence. I managed, I think, to do a fairly even documentary.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't come down on either side, Edward de Vere, the Earl of Oxford, or the Stratford man. But it couldn't help but lean toward Edward de Vere because there was no evidence on the other side.
Yeah. So in your mind, who do you think Shakespeare was?
Edward de Vere.
Okay.
Yeah, the 17th Earl of Oxford. And the more I learn, the more I am convinced that he was. I think I would bet my life that it wasn't the Stratford man.
Mm-hmm.
And I would bet my life about against $100 that it was Edward de Vere.
Mm-hmm. And I was reading your blog, and there was a blog where you're talking to teachers, and I major in political science in South America, so I became a writer here in the U.S. in English, but I've never really made any research on literature for any of my projects. I am more into the war, kind of World War II era thing. So I wonder, why are you so upset about, I have no clue what they're teaching in school about Shakespeare, to be honest, but it called my attention in your blog that you're calling the teachers and lazy liars,
yes.
Basically.
Either lazy or liars,
yeah.
Yes.
So,
that's not all teachers, because a lot of teachers are on to de Vere, and at least on to the question, and will give it equal time, more or less.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people that are just assuming that this Stratford man was Shakespeare, and they're just teaching that in school with no evidence whatsoever?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And I think that's a swindle. I think students are being robbed of their tuition money if they're being taught that the Stratford man was Shakespeare and not taught that there's a controversy or given some of the evidence that Edward Vere was Shakespeare. And the people with vested interest in making us think that it was a Stratford man are those who have written biographies about him and histories about him and who have been teaching all along that the guy from Stratford was Shakespeare. So they have this vested interest. They can't afford to be found out as wrong. They'd lose their careers, lose their reputations.
Yeah.
And so little by little, they've devised a real clever plan of keeping the general public from knowing. First, it's ridicule. The person who first stumbled onto, he didn't stumble onto it. He devised a way of finding out who Shakespeare was. But the first person to blow the whistle was a guy named Looney. And so the Stratfordians leaped on that. Looney, oh boy, that's funny. And they've kept using that. You hear that all the time in the arguments that do take place. Looney discovered him. And then they go to a woman named Delia Bacon who thought that Francis Bacon was the author, and they took those two names as showing how screwball the research has been. Well, it hasn't been at all.
Mm-hmm.
But the most successful plot that they've used to keep people in the dark is the argument that, the play's the thing. As though it doesn't matter who wrote them, we got the plays.
Hmm.
And the fact is, it makes a whole lot of difference. For instance, a fairly new finding by a guy named Richard Rowe. Richard Whalen.
Mm-hmm.
Was that Othello one of the major tragedies, supposedly, of Shakespeare? It wasn't a tragedy at all. It isn't a tragedy. It's a comedy called a savage comedy or Commedia dell'arte. And the only way to have discovered that method, Commedia dell'arte, which involves seven stock characters who always do the same thing, was to have gone to Italy in the 1500s. And Shakespeare of Stratford never went to Italy, but Edward de Vere did. He spent a year there and was fascinated by their Renaissance progress.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you read Othello knowing that it's a comedy, it comes out entirely different and a lot better. That's just one of the things that people are missing by not knowing who wrote it.
Do you think, you know, unfortunately, before the internet, we were really, really just tied up to what we learned in the classroom. But now with the internet, there's a lot of personal research that we all do for everything, just any question that we have. Or do you think the internet is kind of providing a good source for this controversy, or we're still not there?
I hadn't thought of that, but I think it could be. But the first thing is to get people interested. They've bought into the idea that it doesn't matter. The general public has. And that's really, that isn't why I wrote the book, but as it turns out, I think the book is a good way to get interested in the cottage. It's an adventure story, and it's easy to read. The case is simplified in it and made clear. And so I hope that it would spark the interest that would get people on the internet, because there is a lot of stuff on there about this. You can, and it's fascinating. It's really fascinating.
Yeah, and it is important. I mean, I'm the daughter of parents that grew up during the fascism, and everything they went to school and learned were lies. And I even have the history books to prove it.
Mm-hmm.
So. Even if it's a question of literature or art or anything that you would think it's not, relevant in today's life, it actually is important that people learn the truth and the right facts in history. Because
and then there's the point. Here's this guy who's the greatest writer of all times,
mm-hmm.
I think, and a lot of people think. He ought to get the credit.
Yeah.
He shouldn't be cheated out of it. He ought to get this piece of immortality. And I think it hurts me that he doesn't.
Yeah, and well, I think you're putting your little speck of sand in there, not only with your book, but also with your blog posting. And so there, the internet will spark something.
Well,
it did spark my own interest, though. But I am curious now, how did the book come about, and, you know, out of this documentary?
I had written an earlier mystery called The Adagio with the same central character, Jack Duncan, and this is a freestanding sequel.
Mm.
And so I started to make it a mystery, and it is a mystery. Set in Omaha, and I had already done the documentary about the Shakespeare thing, and there was so much eerie about that I came across so many strange things that happened. I thought it would be a good place to take the story, to have the plot wind its way to England and get caught up in some of that strangeness. And then when it did get there, I didn't plot the mystery to begin with. I decided to let the character take me there, wherever circumstances and his method of doing things took me. So once I got involved, the two mysteries got involved, Shakespeare and a murder mystery, the Shakespeare part of it sort of took me over, and it became the central point.
Mm. That's interesting. I always loved how authors come up with a very original idea in their book or a mystery or whatever, and then it's fascinating to me to see how much of their own experiences is there in the origination of this project, you know? So you find sometimes that the research you did for a different project prompted you to write more about this and stuff, and I think this is wonderful.
Well, I can't help but use what I know, and mm-hmm. and so it comes out. In this case, the book is, in a sense, fact disguised as fiction.
Mm-hmm.
But the central character isn't real. He's, I suppose there are elements of me in him, but he's much more impulsive.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets into greater scrapes than I do. He is not me about plotting. I mentioned that I don't plot. I was telling another guy who writes books that I didn't, and he thought that's the wrong way to do it. He said he plots by writing the last line of the book.
Oh, wow.
And then he works his way toward that. I thought that was pretty strange, but my method of writing is to let the central character take me wherever he wants to go.
Yeah.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specializing in interviewing published authors about their current books and areas of expertise. Join us and hear both well-known and upcoming writers talking candidly about their life experience as well as the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, we strive to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are available 24/7 through Direct Podcast as well as MP3 download for your convenience. Please visit us on InsideScoopLive.com.
Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Today I'm talking with Alan Austin, award-winning documentary filmmaker, reporter, and author of The Cut. Stay tuned because we're going to continue this personal conversation with Alan about filming documentary, his experiences while researching crime stories by interviewing death row prisoners, and his reporting assignments in Vietnam. But in the meantime, you can check out his book, The Cottage, by visiting his website at alankaustin.authorsexpress.com. And that is authors, and without the E, express.com.
It's funny that you mentioned that although it's fiction, it's really fact about. And I think it's very appropriate to your background because you are a reporter also. I mean, you've done documentaries. Everything is also, done a lot of research in facts. And you've done a lot of crime stories, I think, something that I read in your email that really stayed with me, and it was, you actually got to know prisoners.
Yes.
And follow them all the way to their execution.
Yes, I did.
I got to ask questions about this because I never met anybody that's done this. So what does it feel like, I mean, to see somebody? Because I can't help but think that once you meet somebody, whether it's guilty or innocent, and you're kind of having conversations with that person, there's got to be some type of relationship that will be shocking to see them die. You know, whether they are criminals or not.
Yeah.
So I wonder, what does it feel like? Did you feel like a sense of loss when they got executed? Or
yes, that was the case with me, that I did get to know. His name was Clifford Bogus,
mm-hmm.
and he was executed about 15 years ago. And I didn't exactly spend the 4 years with him, but I was talking to him through 4 years, him and his family,
mm-hmm.
and people who knew him, and I did get to know him quite well. And our reason for choosing him was that we wanted someone who didn't deny his guilt,
mm-hmm.
and he didn't. That way we could talk to him and not have to go through attorneys.
Okay.
And he had changed completely in prison, as most of them do. He had found Jesus, and he wanted to donate his organs to someone, but you can't do that after you've been executed because the chemicals ruin them. I'm straying from the question, but I did get personally involved with him, and it was the execution was like a tragedy to me, and I have yet to get over it.
Wow.
And then when I discovered that his cellmate was innocent and was executed, that gave me more regrets because I hadn't known that. I wasn't able to quiz him much because his attorney wouldn't allow it. He should have. I might have helped him.
Mm-hmm. I wonder sometimes. I always wonder. I grew up in a different judicial system. And so it was more like a closed-door office. Everything is done by documents. There's no live trial. And I always thought that the U.S. system was a lot better because it's so open that in my mind, the innocent would always be innocent and will be free, and you would never be, you know, executed or spend your life in prison unless you were guilty. And when I moved to the U.S. and I've seen so many cases, so many cases, it made me really wonder, you know, about the death penalty, and it made me and about how flawless I thought everything was.
Yeah, well, maybe justice would be done more often if the attorneys that the accused were given were better caliber.
Yeah.
But a lot of sloppy defense work going on.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think that's true.
In the case of this cellmate of Clifford Boggess, whom I learned was innocent,
mm-hmm.
He and a friend of his were both tried and convicted and executed for the murder of the other person's relatives, three of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the prosecutor was the same on both cases. They tried them separately. And in both cases, the prosecutor claimed that the person he was trying was the sole killer. And he got them both convicted.
Oh. That's actually lying in court?
Yes.
Wow. Oh, Lord. Well, there's a story there, you know?
Yeah. And I do intend to write a book about that.
Yeah. Well, let me know, please. Put it everywhere on the Internet because that's really interesting to me. It's just things like that should never happen. But you write The Cottage as a detective story. Am I correct?
Yes. Uh-huh.
And it's
not a detective story, but as a
investigation.
A suspect in a murder story.
Yeah, but it's dealing with literature credit, and I think that's fascinating. How do you do that? How do you relate the system of investigating, you know, and make it something about literature credit? it's amazing.
I'm not even sure, and two reviewers of this book have said they couldn't categorize it. Is it a mystery? Is it real? Is it fiction? And I can't either. But it just seemed natural to do. Afterwards, I got to thinking, what is this? What have I done here? And I can't really answer it, except I got to thinking that, you know, the movie Wall Street,
mm-hmm.
it was fiction, but it was telling the truth.
Yeah.
And the same is true about Uncle Tom's Cabin. The book Oil, a lot of To Kill a Mockingbird, that was fiction, but it was certainly an accurate portrayal of justice in the South.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's putting on airs to compare my book to that, but I think that's close to what I ended up doing.
Yeah.
Was telling some truth through a piece of fiction and an adventure. It's more an adventure, I would say, than a mystery.
And I think those are the best books. For our listeners, the book is The Cottage, and you can find it. I know you have a website, and I'm pretty sure you can find it everywhere, but your website is www.alankaustin.com. alanexpress.authorsexpress.com. And I want to spell this out. It's alanexpress.com. I encourage everybody to check out your blog as well, because I found it fascinating as well.
I'm glad you spelled that out. I'm not sure I could have.
Yeah, years of practice. But I want to talk about something else that I found very, very interesting, because I am a war nut. I just love all war stories, but from a different point of view. I look at the war stories from the civilian side, where the war is taking place.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, since I was a kid, growing up with so many people in Venezuela that were actually World War II refugees, from Italy, Germany, and Britain, everybody, you know, that were looking for a future went to South America or the U.S. And so I was just a war nut. And you do have 3 reporting visits to Vietnam.
Yes.
And I have to ask you about, you know, just tell us a little bit about that. What was your experience there?
Well, I went more or less alone for a month the first time, and the experience was generally being under-equipped because I wasn't a photographer, but I had to be one. And the technology then was very poor. That was 1967.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the film I took was with a Bell & Howell camera. You only get about 30 seconds out of each shot. And then you have to rewind it, and you only have 3 minutes worth of film in it to begin with. And I, with no talent for this sort of thing, was more or less at a loss. I would hitchhike out to the helicopters out to where I thought the war was taking place,
mm-hmm.
armed with this camera. And at one point, it rained hard all day, and the viewfinder in the camera got fogged up. So the next day when the sun was out, I unscrewed it and laid it on a rock to dry. And a monkey jumped down from a tree, picked up my viewfinder, and went back in the tree, and I never got it back. So the rest of the time that I was shooting film, I was doing it by guesswork.
Oh, wow.
But that's a frivolous story to tell, but I grew to love the Vietnamese people. I have never seen such an obvious mass courage. They just are able to weather anything, and history bears that out. No one's ever been able to conquer Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
And make it last. It just can't be done. And another thing that struck me while I was there all 3 times was, I don't know what it means still, but going through villages, we'd see lots of people looking at us being soldiers, because I was always with soldiers or Marines, and they would look at us with nothing in their eyes, blank.
And a lot of people might not even know what that means. I can tell you something. I've met people like that, and I want to say that it's, you know, it comes to a point, and I grew up with post-traumatic stress parents, you know, and family relatives and whatever, and I really think it's just the resignation of whatever that comes, and it's my experience. The people that I've met, and I can see blank gazes on them, it's people that were just, you know, whatever. I mean, they've seen so much.
Yeah.
That there's there's no hate, there's no love, it's just whatever.
They're going to bear out whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Find a way to get through it.
Yep. And it is sad, but at the same time, it's a survival mechanism, I would imagine,
mm-hmm.
you know, right, that people would have. Of all the things that you saw in Vietnam, what is the one thing, and I want to ask you this because we're running into the end of our time, and I like to ask, what have you learned? And I want to ask you both things that I think are important is, what have you learned in all your reporting jobs by meeting just the regular people, by seeing the facts from behind as a reporter, you know, because a reporter, you, I don't think you can put much input of what you're feeling or seeing or interpreting what you're seeing. You have to report it as they happen. So I wonder, what did you take from you from, you know, Vietnam or doing those research on people that were accused of crimes and executed that you wish other people would see?
Well, I saw pointlessness, destruction with no goal, at least on the from this very small vantage point that I had, seeing a few people at a time. It just seemed so worthless and so unnecessary. I couldn't see any gain being made anywhere there. North Vietnam, North Ireland, Northern Ireland. it just seemed almost masochistic.
Wow, you know, well said. I think that's the biggest. I've asked questions like this very often to my parents. My parents would never talk about what they saw, and it's the pointlessness. They never mentioned that, and I think it's they felt it. But they never say it, you know. I think that they're what they learned in redoing their lives and was that the truth was always needed, and because they were traumatized as kids when the Allies came and they realized that everything they learned about the Allies were lies, basically what it is, and so they couldn't trust anybody. And you're right, though. What was the point of that? You know, so pointlessness. I'll keep that in my mind. A very, very insightful comment. Thank you.
Thank you.
Again, listeners, your book is The Cottage. Again, your website is alankaustin.authorsexpress.com. There's no E on the express, so it's authorsexpress.com. Again, thank you so much for being with us. I can't wait to read your book. I will read your book. I think it's amazing that you wrote something about literature in an investigative, adventurous way, and I can't wait to see it.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate this. Oh, thank you. And listeners, thank you again for being with us, and until next time.